One of the main ideas of that poetry notebook is in the title, Mantra. It's the main idea. And there are several chapters in the future poetry which have mantra in the title. And in the future poetry, Sri Aurobindo went to some considerable lengths to try to tell us what the word means. So then what I have done in that notebook is, and in the lectures, is focus on his definitions, and then I've tried to elaborate a little bit and also demonstrate. So if you listen to the recording, you get a better idea than from reading the notebook, and they're available online. The fact is that what we saw in the last hour, the translation and commentary on the Rig Veda, shows us a structure of symbolic meanings. And the cantos that we will hear tonight will be quite close in meaning and to that structure. So the way I deal with this is I say that the Vedic structure underlies the cantos of Savitri. The big difference is that Sri Aurobindo wrote Savitri as mantra. Mantra. You cannot, well, and I've explained in this notebook what mantra means, but just to recall a little bit what he says the mantra is a direct and most heightened and intensest and most divinely burdened rhythmic word which embodies an intuitive and revelatory inspiration and ensouls the mind with the sight and presence of the very self, the inmost reality of things. That rhythmic word ensouls the mind with the inner reality of the thing itself. If it doesn't do that, if it's not simultaneous hearing and seeing what is being said, then he says it's not mantra. So one does not read Savitri in order to understand Vedic structure like we were just understanding it in the last hour. One reads Savitri in order to see and hear the darkness itself, the ignorance itself. If you don't go away from a hearing of Savitri with an altered perception of the truth of things, then you haven't heard it. And so he says repeatedly in the future poetry, the I cannot get it. Only the ear can get it. So sitting and poring over Savitri with your eyes will give you a hint, a glimpse of the meaning, but you will not get the real revelatory, inspired presence of the thing itself. That only comes through hearing. So that's Sri Aurobindo's definition. And as I said last time, when you understand how the Vedic structure underlies his poetry and his yoga, you have understood something that's very important, no doubt. But he could not have produced the energy of consciousness by simply translating and commenting on the Veda. That is the way the Vedic rishis produced consciousness, when that language and those images had that power. He took the trouble to write Savitri so that there would be a mantric transmission of that knowledge that would be effective today. His work was to give us Savitri, Savitri herself, not a Vedic structure of meaning. So Savitri is that sound image power that alters consciousness by revealing to consciousness a perception that our minds don't have. So that's the introduction tonight, because the book that we're going to start tonight, called The Traveler of the Worlds, contains and shows a perception of reality that is surprising, that is very unusual. There is nothing here that you have read anywhere else. Sri Aurobindo has conveyed through this book a vision of the inner workings of existence, the subtlest and the most luminous and the darkest and gravest and most painful aspects of existence that anybody has ever attempted to put into speech, especially into speech that is meant to carry the reality itself to the hearer. So this is serious work. Sri Aurobindo wants to put us in front of that darkness. He wants to put us in the emptiness, in the void. And then, after beating us up a little bit, he wants to bring us out into our own stupidity along the way. And he wants us to feel it, and see it, and know it. And then he wants to show us a vision of a power that can change it. But he wants us to feel that too, something that we don't feel normally. He wants us to feel present, the presence of the reality of that thing itself. So this is not symbolism, this is mantra. It's a potential of speech that he says no age of human development has ever been farther from understanding. So for him to bring that understanding to us is an absolutely extraordinary feat. of yogic power. Now, in order to really appreciate that, it is necessary to read a full canto in one sitting, because the canto is structured rhythmically to bring you to that hearing through the rhythmic development. And sometimes you will have 60 or 80 lines that are basically made up of the same types of images, but you don't really come to the full grasp of that image until you get to the end of it. And then it's just clear. You know, it's that. So in this course, I am undertaking to survey a book of cantos. So I am not doing what I say has to be done in order to really understand Savitri. So I said that last time, and I'll keep saying that, because it really is important to realize that what I'll be doing tonight is not what Sri Aurobindo intends. I will just be giving us fragments of different cantos from a book, with the idea that we might gain an appreciation of the structure of that book in relation to the other 12 books. So this is a little more abstract undertaking than would be best in order to really understand Savitri. But I think that if this the workbook that we have from the last session and the survey that we get from this session all together will give some guidelines that for the student of Savitri will be useful, but it still won't be Savitri. And even this is not Savitri. Savitri is the power of illuminating speech that manifests through sound. So this is like the sheet music. If you have a very subtle perception and a very strong concentration, then you might be able to hear it sometimes silently. But I have been experimenting with it for a long time, and I still don't hear the same thing silently that I hear when I really hear the sound. So it's real. Another thing that he says about mantra, just to grab a quotation from here, he says, "The decisive, revealing, lyrical outburst must come when the poet has learned to live creatively only in the inmost spiritual sight and identity of his own self with the self of his objects, and to sing only from the deepest spiritual emotion, which is the ecstasy of the feeling of that identity between the self and the object, or at least of some extreme nearness to its sheer directness of touch and vision." Touch. The sensation of touch is intended to be conveyed by this power of speech. something very sensible is meant to be felt. So in order to achieve that, it's necessary to have a very quiet space, undivided attention, and to render a full canto, and to allow the tonalities to be determined from within the canto and not by the mind of the reader. So that's possible. We've done it many times. That's not what we're doing tonight. Last time, I'm just going to run back a little bit here into book one. I pointed out that the structure of book one is essentially twofold. It shows Sri Aurobindo's cosmological vision of the two who are one, Purusha and Prakriti. That's a kind of horizontal view of time and space and the meaning of the universe. And he shows the steps of the yoga of transformation in a vertical order. Canto 3 begins with his first illuminations, and Canto 5 ends with his absolute union with the divine Shakti and all the levels of mind and higher mind and illumined mind and cosmic consciousness are described in those three cantos, while at the same time in those three cantos, many images are given of the essential nature of existence which makes that vertical evolution possible. So just as a reminder of the cosmological vision aspect, there are these lines. Starting here, along a path of eons serpentine, along a path of eons serpentine, in the coiled blackness of her nescient course, the Earth Goddess toils across the sands of time. A being is in her whom she hopes to know. A word speaks to her heart she cannot hear. A fate compels whose form she cannot see. In her unconscious orbit through the void, out of her mindless depths, she strives to rise. A perilous life her gain, a struggling joy, a thought that can conceive but hardly knows, arises slowly in her and creates the idea, the speech that labels more than it lights. A trembling gladness that is less than bliss invades from all this beauty that must die. Alarmed by the sorrow dragging at her feet, and conscious of the high things not yet won, ever she nurses in her sleepless breast an inward urge that takes from her rest and peace. Ignorant and weary, and invincible. She seeks through the soul's war and quivering pain the pure perfection her marred nature needs. A breath of Godhead on her stone and mire. A faith she craves that can survive defeat. The sweetness of a love that knows not death. The radiance of a truth forever sure. A light grows in her. She assumes a voice. Her state she learns to read and the act she has done. But the one needed truth eludes her grasp. Herself. And all of which she is the sign. So this is the ignorant world mother in her march through time, the horizontal movement, and her other pole, the two who are one. Why does she do this? How does she manage? What keeps her going? Sorry, I have to get to page 66 here. This one. The master of existence lurks in us and plays at hide and seek with his own force. In nature's instrument loiters secret God. The immanent lives in man as in his house. He has made the universe his pastime's field. A vast gymnasium of his works of might. All-knowing, he accepts our darkened state. Divine wears shapes of animal or man. Eternal, he assents to fate and time. Immortal, dallies with mortality. The all-conscious ventured into ignorance. The all-blissful bore to be insensible. Incarnate in a world of strife and pain. He puts on joy and sorrow like a robe, and drinks experience like a strengthening wine. He whose transcendence rules the pregnant vasts, prescient now dwells in our subliminal depths, a luminous individual power alone. The absolute, the perfect, the alone has called out of the silence his mute force, where she lay in the featureless and formless hush, guarding from time by her immobile sleep the ineffable puissance of his solitude. the absolute, the perfect, the alone, has entered with his silence into space. He has fashioned these countless persons of one self. He has built a million figures of his power. He lives in all who lived in his vast alone. Space is himself, and time is only he. The absolute, the perfect, the immune, one who is in us as our secret self, our mask of imperfection has assumed. He has made this tenement of flesh his own, his image in the human measure cast, that to his divine measure we might rise. Then, in a figure of divinity, the Maker shall recast us and impose a plan of Godhead on the mortal's mold, lifting our finite minds to his infinite, touching the moment with eternity. This transfiguration is earth's due to heaven. A mutual debt binds man to the supreme. His nature we must put on as he put ours. We are sons of God and must be even as he. His human portion, we must grow divine. Our life is a paradox with God for key. So the inner being, the Purusha, evolves through the eons of time and space as she, he and she, the two who are one. The immortal and the mortal, the eternal and the temporal, the two sides of power. So, when we move now into the second book called The World's Stair, Sri Aurobindo changes his focus. He's no longer looking at the big picture and at the two who are one. He is now looking at the two who are not one. The darkness and the light. Life and death. Because now in manifestation they are divided. So all of Book 2, The Traveler of the Worlds, is a constant play of dualities. Very repetitious. Many cantos say almost the same thing as other cantos. Many images are repeated with just slight variations of image or syntax. And the meaning of that is that this is not a kind of linear book which needs to be read from beginning to end. This is a book in which there are many cantos that say the same thing, and the point is for us to hear what's being said. So one canto can be read 100 times and always reveal some other degree of power and meaning. I have read Canto 5 of Book 1 more than 100 times. For 10 years, basically, I read only that canto. So, I hope that doesn't interfere with what we're doing. I'm going to begin now on page 100 with The World Stare and go through a few cantos. I can't see. I hope an okay works there. Where's page 100? And what we'll hear tonight is many images that come from the Veda that we just heard, of the light entering into the darkness and what that darkness really is and what that light really is. That's what Sri Aurobindo wants us to hear. And so he has a vision of that. He is standing right in front of it, looking right at it. He's not inventing anything. He is transmitting to us an essential spiritual knowledge of what is. It's only up to us to tune in and hear it. And in this book, he says it in 100 different ways. There are 13 cantos in this book, and they all say basically the same thing. But there is a progression. He moves from the subtle physical through the vital, the subtle vital, the external vital, the subtle mental, the rational mental, the overmental, higher mind and overmind and supermind, inside and outside, always juxtaposing these levels of being with their, always juxtaposing their dark side and their light side. So that we see that the movement which happens is the play of the dark and the light. So he gives us the dark, he gives us the light, and then he gives us the play at every level. And that's the structure of this book. I'm going to begin with a passage which I find extremely beautiful and powerful and also introductory, from the first canto of this book. And this comes about in the middle of the canto. And it is a statement of the juxtaposition of the dark and the light and what that means. A mystery's process is the universe. Now, we all thought it was made up of mathematical physics, right? A mystery's process is the universe. At first was laid a strange, anomalous base. A void, a cipher of some secret hole, where zero held infinity in its sum, and all and nothing were a single term. An eternal negative, a matrix naught. Into its forms the child is ever born, who lives forever in the vasts of God. That means that the emptiness is always an essential aspect of what is present. And so it is necessary to enter into the emptiness, the void, in order to understand reality in any of its forms. Because every form, as the Buddhists have known for a long time, the essence, the truth of every form is emptiness. And the appearance is only an appearance. The force is a result of time and space in the emptiness. This doesn't exist. We only think it exists because we have sensations. We believe that our sensory organism is telling us something about reality. What actually exists here is the child who is ever born in the void. So the void is a very important truth of existence. It's not a negation. It is the negative aspect of existence, but it's not a negation. So we will see, as we go through all the books of Savitri, and especially the next book, book 3, Sri Aurobindo dwells in the void for an unmeasurable number of years before the light really descends. And we hear this void again and again in Savitri. So here is the beginning of the revelation of the nature of existence, which, if we really want to understand, we have to enter into the absolute negation. So I'm going to move on from there now to the next canto. The next canto is called The Kingdom of Subtle Matter. This is the beginning of the adventure of the yogi through all the worlds of our manifest spatial temporal order. We are now going to be shown the insides of everything that we know the outside of. And the first big surprise comes on this first page. Starting here and going down to here. Now there's a whole canto here that dwells upon this understanding, this vision, this reality. This is only a fragment. A world of lovelier forms lies near to ours, where, undisguised by earth's deforming sight, all shapes are beautiful and all things true. In that lucent ambience, mystically clear, the eyes were doors to a celestial sense. Hearing was music and the touch a charm, and the heart drew a deeper breath of power. There dwell earth nature's shining origins, the perfect plans on which she molds her works. The distant outcomes of her travailing force repose in a framework of established fate, attempted vainly now, or won in vain. Already were mapped and scheduled there the time and figure of her future sovereignties in the sumptuous lineaments traced by desire. Desire is the motive force of manifestation, and we will see her again and again. Here we get the first glimpse of this power that drives manifest existence. Where it comes from, all of its different layers and levels, and what it eventually becomes when it is transformed into the pure divine power, desire. So, where does it come from? I think I have that here. Well, just to continue this image a little bit, I'm going to move over to page 107. This is a long book, and I'm going to do it in two sessions, to this week and next week, because there are some short books that I can put together in one session. There are two very short books. So we can spend a little bit more time on this book. So remember that, which we just read. About that subtle physical where everything is mapped and beautiful. For long before Earth's solid vest was forged by the technique of the atomic void, a lucent envelope of self-disguise was woven round the secret spirit in things. The subtle realms from those bright sheaths were made. This wonder world, with all its radiant boon of vision and inviolate happiness, only for expression cares and perfect form. Fair on its peaks, it has dangerous nether plains. Its light draws towards the verge of nature's lapse. It lends beauty to the terror of the gulfs and fascinating eyes to perilous gods. Invests with grace the demon and the snake. Its trance imposes Earth's inconscience. Immortal, it weaves for us death's somber robe and authorizes our mortality. So the spirit wove around itself, long before even the atomic void was created, this pattern of evolution and experience and life and death unending. For what? He asks the question. Sri Aurobindo asks the question. Well, I think I'll just finish this section. This medium, the subtle physical, if you read the agenda, you will notice that the mother is often commenting on her travels in the subtle physical. Meeting people, seeing the way things are going, talking to the carpet, which is alive with memories. This medium serves a greater consciousness, a vessel of its concealed autocracy. It is the subtle ground of matter's worlds. It is the immutable in their mutable forms. In the folds of its creative memory, it guards the deathless type of perishing things. Its lowered potencies found our fallen strengths. Its thought invents our reasoned ignorance. Its sense fathers our body's reflexes. Our secret breath of untried, mightier force, the lurking sun of an instant's inner sight, its fine suggestions are a covert fount. For our iridescent, rich imaginings, touching things common with transfiguring hues, till even Earth's mud grows rich and warm with the skies, and a glory gleams from the soul's decadence. Its knowledge is our error's starting point. Its beauty dons our mud mask ugliness. Its artist good begins our evil's tale. A heaven of creative truths above, a cosmos of harmonious dreams between, a chaos of dissolving forms below. It plunges lost in our inconscient base. Out of its fall, our denser matter came. Thus taken was God's plunge into the night. This fallen world became a nurse of souls, inhabited by concealed divinity. A being woke and lived in the meaningless void. A worldwide nescience strove towards life and thought. A consciousness plucked out from mindless sleep. All here is driven by an insentient will. Thus fallen, inconscient, frustrate, dense, inert. Sunk into inanimate and torpid drowse, Earth lay, a drudge of sleep, forced to create by a subconscious yearning memory left from a happiness dead before she was born. An alien wonder on her senseless breast. Sorry, I didn't hear you, Margit.
Left from a happiness dead before she was born. She is nine.
She was night.
She is nine.
Now we'll hear a lot about the night. For a while we'll hear nothing but night here. This book is about night. Now we just got started into the night. We just descended. Fell, the divine plunged into the void. And now we will hear about that. That void we will get to know intimately. I mean, there's one unbelievable passage in here which I'll get to, but first I'm going to do this one. There's one passage in which Sri Aurobindo describes how this darkness feels. In itself, this emptiness that covers up all light. It's quite an image. And he obviously feels that we should know about this because he has devoted many sleepless nights to writing it for us to know. In the most powerful language. So this is a summary of that fall, but the fall itself. In the crude beginnings of this mortal world, life was not. Nor mind's play, nor heart's desire. When earth was built in the unconscious void, and nothing was save a material scene, identified with sea and sky and stone, her young gods yearned for the release of souls asleep in objects. Vague, inanimate. In that desolate grandeur, in that beauty bare, in the deaf stillness, mid the unheeded sounds, heavy was the uncommunicated load of Godhead in a world that had no needs, for none was there to feel or to receive. This solid mass, which brooked no throb of sense, could not contain their vast creative urge, immersed no more in matter's harmony, the spirit lost its statuesque repose. In the uncaring trance, it groped for sight. Passioned for the movements of a conscious heart, famishing for speech and thought and joy and love in the dumb, insensitive, wheeling day and night, hungered for the beat of yearning and response, the poised inconscience shaken with a touch. The intuitive silence trembling with a name. They cried to life, to invade the senseless mold and in brute forms awake divinity. A voice was heard on the mute rolling globe. A murmur moaned in the unlistening void. A being seemed to breathe where once was none. Something pent up in dead, insentient depths. Denied conscious existence, lost to joy, turned as if one asleep since dateless time, aware of its own buried reality, remembering its forgotten self and right. It yearned to know, to aspire, to enjoy, to live. Life heard the call and left her native light. Overflowing from her bright, magnificent plane, on the rigid coil and sprawl of mortal space. Here too the gracious, great-winged angel poured her splendor and her swiftness and her bliss, hoping to fill a fair new world with joy, as comes a goddess to a mortal's breast and fills his days with her celestial clasp. She stooped to make her home in transient shapes, in matter's womb. She cast the immortal's fire. In the unfeeling vast, woke thought and hope. Smote with her charm and beauty, flesh and nerve, and forced delight on earth's insensible frame. In the crude beginnings of this mortal world, life was not. But the gods, on that plane nearer to the original descent, brought into that inconscient, insentient, bare void a yearning to become everything beautiful and powerful and divine. And that call, according to this image, was heard by life, the goddess. So in this vision, life is the mother. She is that which just poured itself into the void, which was created first by his descent into absolute nothing. Then she follows and the play begins. So I just want to capture that one image that I mentioned. Well, the beginning of Canto 4 on page 133, we get this image reinforced. There strayed a call that knew not why it came. A power beyond earth's scope has touched the earth. The repose that might have been can be no more. A formless yearning passions in man's heart, a cry is in his blood for happier things. Else could he roam on a free sunlit soil with the childlike pain-forgetting mind of beasts, or live happy, unmoved, like flowers and trees. The might that came upon the earth to bless has stayed on earth to suffer and aspire. The infant laugh that rang through time is hushed. Man's natural joy of life is overcast, and sorrow is his nurse of destiny. The animal's thoughtless joy is left behind. Care and reflection burden his daily walk. He has risen to greatness and to discontent. He is awake to the invisible, insatiate seeker. He has all to learn. An eyeless power that sees no more its aim. A restless, hungry energy of will. Life cast her seed in the body's indolent mold. It woke from happy torpor, a blind force, compelling it to sense and seek and feel. In the enormous labor of the void, perturbing with her dreams the vast routine and dead roll of a slumbering universe, the mighty prisoner struggled for release. Alive with her yearning, woke the inert cell. In the heart, she kindled a fire of passion and need. Amid the deep calm of inanimate things, arose her great voice of toil and prayer and strife. So, there we have the essential juxtaposition of life and death, life and matter, the power to rise again to the divine heights through very slow, incremental evolutionary progress. the technique of the atomic void. Don't forget that image. Into the void, the child is ever born. The technique of the atomic void. The two who are one are the secret of all power. The darkness and the light in that special combination known as existence. So the dark, the negative side is always there, and the life power is there potentially from the beginning. So that's what probably you're referring to, is that that atomic void has the potential to evolve life from the beginning. That's the sacrifice of the Purusha. Then there is the sacrifice of the Mother, the Holocaust of the Supreme, where she descends through all the planes. So that's another image from Book One. Or actually from the first canto of this book. I hope I can find this. Yeah. So here it is again, from a very, very profound, subtle perception. You want to read it? I'll bring it up here, page 220. This will be the last. What's that? Yeah. What canto is this? 8. Oh, here's a canto which we're skipping, basically. The Descent into Night. This one is really dark. If you want to have a good experience, that's a good one. But the one that we're coming to now is still carrying that one on, and maybe we'll go back and capture that one next time. But here is something that only Sri Aurobindo could convey, because it's part of his vision that it's absolutely necessary to enter into the darkness in order to evolve. And that's the beginning of existence, and it's recapitulated in the life of the yogi. In order to bring that power of consciousness into this evolving human being, it's necessary to go back to that original emptiness. And in order to get there, you have to pass through all of these subtle planes where things are not necessarily beautiful. I'm not going to go there right now. I'm going to go here, because I want us to catch this, and it's getting late. A shadow substance into emptiness came. Dim forms were born in the unthinking void, and eddies met and made an adverse space. in whose black folds being imagined hell. His eyes, piercing the triple-plated gloom, identified their sight with its blind stare. His eyes identified their sight with its blind stare. That means he was willing to stare at absolute blindness, to see nothing, and to keep nothing in view. Accustomed to the unnatural dark, they saw. His eyes. Unreality made real. And conscious night. The emptiness, conscious of its own essence, unreality made real. To know unreality is to know the origin, the base. A violent, fierce, and formidable world. An ancient womb of huge, calamitous dreams, coiled like a larva in the obscurity that keeps it from the spear points of heaven's stars. It was the gate of a false infinite. An eternity of disastrous absolutes. An immense negation of spiritual things. All once self-luminous in the spirit sphere turned now into their own dark contraries. Being collapsed into a pointless void that yet was a zero parent of the worlds. Inconscience swallowing up the cosmic mind. Produced a universe from its lethal sleep. Bliss into black coma, fallen, insensible, coiled back to itself, and God's eternal joy through a false, poignant figure of grief and pain, still dolorously nailed upon a cross, fixed in the soil of a dumb, insentient world where birth was a pang and death an agony, lest all too soon should emerge, should change again to bliss. Lest all too soon should change again to bliss. Time is the result of this imposition of the void on the absolute power. Only by putting that power into the absolute opposite could time exist. And so Sri Aurobindo says, time is the will of the divine. The divine will to enter into nothingness in order to emerge back into light is time. Yeah, and it's time to stop. But to have that perception requires a willingness to surrender to the divine Shakti and to abandon all of the habits that keep us in the dark. All of our sense habits and our thought habits and our aspirations and our joys and our little sorrows and everything have to be plunged back into that essential emptiness in order for that higher power of consciousness to descend again, but this time not as life, this time as supermind.
But in a sense it is very eternal vision, because it goes on till now.
Yeah.
And it is in Egypt, in many civilizations, the same image is used. So yeah. It is not new.
No.
It is eternal, only expressed in a new term.
Yes.
New form.
Yeah. To bring us
Gnostic knowledge.
To bring us closer to the Gnostic
yes.
truth. This is the Gnostic
it is
truth.
Always. Inside, inside.
Absolutely. So this gives you a little taste of book two. It's mostly this juxtaposition of the call from below and the answer from above and the immediate contact with either one or the other at different levels. So after this, we get into mind, greater mind, ideal mind, spiritual mind, and still the same dualities, illusionary dualities at every plane, at every level. And we'll finish that next week.